So, if the Voting Rights Act were not extended, if you repealed all these laws, just say hypothetically, things would not go back.
They would go back, but there wouldn't be a rubber band effect of going all the way back. They would go back some. And there would be more individual abuses than there are now. But Atlanta would not return in any way to segregated restaurants. If you repealed that law. If you repealed the... If you didn't have the federal court rulings, we would still have a majority to minority transfers, but we would not have busing. That's true. But the proponents of the busing argument have already lost that argument in the United States, and there's no way in the world they can win that argument because people just don't believe that. They may at some point in the long-range future, but they sure as hell aren't about to win that argument now. Not the black community or the white community.
Well, it can't go back very far to maintain the consistency of your argument.
That's right. Well, but see...
Except for individual abuses. But as society as a whole cannot go that, slide that far back.
That's right.
If they had the argument with themselves, right. proved the...
Well, if you're saying that... Burke County schools might revert to black schools and white schools if there were no laws. I don't know whether they would.
No, I'm saying going back to an oppressive kind of society again, something like you had, say, 10 years, even just 10 years ago.
There wouldn't be anybody forcing everybody off the sidewalk like there was 10 years ago. There wouldn't be the personal, individual abuse on a maximum. They wouldn't put up colored and white signs over water fountains. You know, there would. The South has been at least sensitized to that kind of.
That would lend proof or credence to your argument.
Right. And
but you had a basic attitude change that was not really related to the passage of laws.
Right.
The laws came in effect to reinforce.
You would not, for example, in this state, you would not go back and purge all the blacks off the voter registration list.
Good point.
Don't give a damn what happened. You just wouldn't do that anymore. Nobody would believe that to be a reasonable process anymore. So I don't know about all the, God knows the ramifications of the racial arguments are too vast for me to understand. But I don't feel that they have the impact in Georgia voting now that they did.
Well, one reason we're spending so much time on this is, you know, B.O. Key's basic hypothesis was that the politics of the South was the politics of race, and you understood that, you understood everything.
Yeah. But see, his other hypothesis about the state of Georgia was that it was the rustic rule, that was really what was important. That may still be more important than race in Georgia, the fact that Latinx lives in Atlanta, but is representative of the rustics may be more important than race.
Is rural versus urban politics the predominant?
Not really, but it has some impact. It's unthinkable that, well, it's not unthinkable either, but the reason Mike Egan would have a hard time running for and getting elected governor is because he lives in Atlanta. In addition to the fact that he's a Republican. The reason that...
How about the fact that he's a Catholic?
It probably could be raised as an issue, but I don't see it as a major issue.
But Atlanta...
Anti-Semitism would be still... a factor to be contended with. But Catholicism, I don't think, is that kind of an issue.
No, really.
I think that it still is more important to be able to put on your campaign brochure that you're Baptist or Methodist than not. But I don't think that in South Georgia people would really say that Mike Egan ought not to be the governor because he's a Catholic.
Is that
they might say that Elliot Levis ought not to be the governor because he's Jewish.
Is that to some extent because of television? In other words, they see Mike Egan, they look at him and say, yeah, he looked like a pretty nice, decent fellow. I mean,
I really think it's because of John Tennant. I really think that that campaign was inspired in terms of tearing down racial prejudice. I mean, religious prejudice in the South. To understand that.
I think he got his largest majority in Georgia, didn't he?
Yeah. And he's got his biggest county majorities in the middle Georgia area around Macon, which was dominated by Mercer University, which is a Baptist institution, and by Baptist theology. I really don't think race, religion is much of a. Is much of a factor.
I'm going to try and paraphrase, but if I'm correct, the basic thesis of Jordan Howell's book on the Southern Strategy was that it was a cynical use of racial prejudice for political purposes. What effect do you think that the Southern Strategy thus defined has had on the Republican Party in Georgia and in the South?
I don't think we'll ever know, because I don't think there was a presidential campaign, a race in 1972. And so there's not ever going to be any data that would tell us whether it was or not. I think it was reasonably effective at gathering a core of people, of believers. But I don't think it would have failed had there been a problem. I think it would have been a very close question, and I think that that cynicism was combined with some other things to make it a potential Republican victory. I think Nixon would not have prevailed in all these southern states had there been a real campaign.
How about as a factor in developing in Republican Party growth and development?
I think it had an impact in some states. I really do, but I don't think it had any impact. It has not had any lasting impact in Georgia. I think it. It's perceived as more. It counts more for the victory of Helms and North Carolina than does any campaign we've had in Georgia. I think it contributed fairly heavily to some Tennessee races. But it seemed to contribute more to Republican victories in the border states, actually, than it did in the Deep South states.
Well, it worked in 1976.
No. Well, under this, you always have to travel under the assumption that the states have to come back to a position that they can sustain as a viable national political party. And if they come back to that position, racial politics would not be effective.
How about the effect in terms of alienating blacks who are growing, somewhat of a growing political force, at least a substantive political force, alienating them from the Republican Party?
Well, I think it did that. And I think it has done, but I think it will continue to do that. And I think the Republican Party has done itself grievous damage in the South because of that. I also happen to think that it took some of the sheen off of being a Republican in the suburban South, because I think people understood it was a pretty damn cheap and tawdry kind of party. And I don't think they really bought that all that much. I think they just didn't have any other way, any other place to go, so they ended up voting. But in 1976, what would really be effective a moderate Democratic candidate who said, hey, look, we can't have this divisive kind of thing. And that swing group in the middle, which all ended up voting for Nixon in 1972 on issues other than race, would go back to the Democrats and form a bloc with that growing black vote, or form a alliance with that black vote, and destroy a cynical kind of racial politics in 1976.
How valuable would you think it would be as a political issue for a presidential candidate in the South in 1976 to, in effect, come in and sort of praise the area for, you know, you people that have done a good job and your race relations are better, you're setting an example, sort of positive reinforcement type thing. How would that be as an effective political issue?
It would be damned effective to do that. But that support of my hypothesis about what may happen in 1976. I really think that one of the southern governors or one of the southern political figures may end up being the presidential candidate in 1976. And the reason I think so is there's a really interesting movement now. People are beginning to understand that the South has moved through a period of adjustment. And that's why, at least, that some other people have not yet even begun to try to move through. And I wouldn't be surprised to see Reuben Askew or Dale Bunker or somebody like that as a presidential candidate. Because I don't think the Democratic Party wants to go back to that Democratic snake pit and try to sort them all out again. And I don't think the country is in the mood to see any of those guys come out of there and try to run for president again.
Which would also sort of solve the Wallace problem for the Democratic Party, wouldn't it?
Precisely right. And, you know, I wouldn't be at all surprised to, for the 1976 nominating conventions for either or both political parties to be held in this city. And the reason I wouldn't be surprised is because that's a different kind of a southern strategy. The sort of southern strategy that says, well, there's one of the new cities that's interesting in America, and you no longer have to draw those regional distinctions. Because I think that the regional distinctions that validly have been drawn will but in a totally different way from how they are now.
Is Atlanta a southern city?
No, not at all. Atlanta is no more a southern city than Milwaukee is. It's a southern city if you say, well, I got more black folks in it than northern cities do.
Can we pursue those regional differences? How do you see those changing? We're writing a book about Southern politics on the assumption that the South is different from the rest of the country. How do you see that changing in the future?
Much more volatile kinds of political change than the rest of the country. Volatile in that same schizophrenic sense of I'm voting for Andrew Young and Lester Maddox. both at the same time. I am volatile in the sense that Southern politicians are going to have to be much more acute in the almost instantly than they have been in the past in terms of national issues, because a good deal of the rest of the country is about to go through some of the agonies that the South has already been through in practical terms. Southern politicians are infinitely more interesting than their counterparts are in the rest of the country now, because they have faced a lot of the issues that these other people are just now going to have to face. For example, Dale Bumpers 2 weeks ago, and he is not the only example, but he is an example, came to town and talked to the American Society of Newspaper Editors about how he didn't want the Ozarks to grow anymore. That's a fairly radical kind of a position. All of them in Arkansas are very radical.
You mean the South might become kind of a center of a slow growth philosophy, or a slight
possible growth? I think it's entirely possible.
That means a complete reversal of what it's doing.
Right.
In terms of tax incentives and all that sort of thing.
Selective growth, is that going to be the key?
Yeah. I'm much more involved in trying to save an environment because we still got time. A Southern governor who didn't think in terms of environmental protection these days, there's not going to be a good thing to do. Not in the long run, not in my opinion. But, you know, still tied to, in many ways, to some of the economic fat cats and trying to please both worlds. And that's why it's so volatile. Not nearly as much wrapped up in some of the sort of current fads as other politicians will be. Consumerism, for example. Consumerism is a funny issue in the South, and it cuts lots of different ways. In the rest of the country, it's very fashionable to be for food control, price controls. Well, in Atlanta, that damn sure is not a fashionable thing to be, because the housewife who lives in suburban Atlanta and goes with A&T has a father who's still raising beef down on the farm in Spalding County. And, and they argue at the Sunday dinner table about that sort of thing. So that kind of stuff. Faddish politics is not going to be important.
Well, is the South going to lose some of its regional characteristics, though?
Yeah,
so well, like, yeah, for example.
Yeah. Gone already. The Saturday afternoon barbecue. Gone already the country music shows in the South. But if you go to Milwaukee with George Wallace, as I did in 1972, he filled the arena in Milwaukee with country music performers, and the audience was standing in room. If he were, and I've seen him do that in Anniston too, but if he were to try to do it in Gainesville, Georgia today, he might not pack the auditorium. You know, it's the kind of responses that they get may not necessarily be as
so. Changes in campaign style is one.
Right? Yeah.
What else is changing?
Well, you know, what already has changed that we were talking about earlier is the racial demagoguery, which is really, you have to look damned hard to find a guy who's doing open racial demagoguery in the South now. There are some examples, but they're in a hell of a minority. A good deal more identification with environmental issues instead of, well, let me back up. Did you say you never wanted to get a vote in a county where they had laid streetcar tracks? Any governor in Georgia who now is not for a rapid transit program in the city of Atlanta is really out of it. He's got to be for a rapid transit program, a mass people moving program. Example, there was a time when the classic pattern in some states of getting to be governor was to either be the commissioner of agriculture or have some job that related to agrarian. I'm not sure that that would be the path to the governor's office. Now, you probably could argue that some identification with rural goals and aspirations still is important, but not to the extent of being the, you know, the commissioner of agriculture.
Yeah, but that could relate to things like health care rather than farm oriented.
There sort of has been a passion for reorganization of state governments in the South, which is basically meaningless. But
how do you assess Carter's administration?
Wretched.
Why?
Wretched. He went into all those reorganization programs and made a mess of just about every state department.
And what? How? I mean, by the people he selected, or?
Well, for example, he put together what is called a Department of Human Resources. Gathered together 22,000 people, and it thought of gobbledygook names for welfare programs, and it thought of euphemisms for social work. And they managed to confuse everybody in every program, and they just never made any of it work. He called the prison system the Department of Offender Rehabilitation or some such thing. You know, an attempt to dress up with an interesting or cute phrase. The problem. And that's really not administration. But the basic thing that Carter did was he has consistently and completely misled the the voters from one side to another and kept them just totally confused all the time about what it is he stands for and what he wants. For example, one year he campaigns very vigorously for a $50 million tax relief program, and the next year he vetoes a $50 million tax relief program. It makes no sense at all, just utterly inconsistent.
Or the program that he chose, the thing when he proposed, was providing tax relief for somebody else.
No, but it was the same base. It wasn't the same technical.
I hadn't studied that at all. I saw some reference to it, and it suggested that what he vetoed was a bill, a tax relief program that really gave relief to what some would consider the wrong people. People who needed relief to leave.
That's true, but the first one he proposed and only got through the legislature was the one that gave the power company the big tax break. I think he has his supporters, but he would run so poorly in Georgia now that he couldn't run for public office.
Now we have heard several people have told us that Carter's basic problem with the public was that he sort of ran as a conservative and advocate of George Wallace and came as a great racial moderate, and in doing so, people don't trust him as a result.
Well, see, I would argue that what he did was he ran as a great conservative and he tried to base his whole program on reorganizing state government, as Dick Russell did in 1932. And And both, I don't think it had much to do with racial things, but they really hadn't appointed all that many people to racial, I mean, the black folks to jobs in the state government or anything like that. It's just that it was sort of a namby-pamby kind of a reorganization thing that didn't work. And that's really what you have to hold him accountable for, because his basic job is to be the governor and to make things work as the administrator. And he just made it confuse every governmental process. I don't know if that, so far has been a racial liberal, I don't see any evidence of that.
How do you rate Carl Sanders?
The best student of government that we've had in Georgia in a long time. Understood how to make it work. A complete opportunity. And the kind of guy that you either absolutely despised or thought was pretty small. Nobody had. Feelings about it. My mom was very positive because in the early 1960s, when a lot of this racial change was going on, he really was a courageous man.
That was basically a sign of a strong politician, that somebody aroused a strong feeling.
Yeah, that's right. That's really, and he, it's a shame that he really didn't, that he just, he lost touch. He really, he's like a lot of other Southern politicians who got away from it and then tried to come back, and they had just lost it. And they hadn't been around in a while and couldn't find the magic anymore.
Carter's problems in his relations with the Senate, how much of that is a result of Maddox playing the role of obstructionist, and how much of it is Carter's not being able to politic his programs through?
They've both been like little boys trying to be the pitcher of the same life baseball. And I don't know who gets most of the blame and who gets less of it.
Is there anything else you wanted to comment on?
No, I don't think of anything.
Yeah, Alan Layton.
I don't know anything else. So.
Would like to ask one last question. That is just your assessment of the impact of reapportionment in Georgia.
We're doing an editorial about that morning, as a matter of fact. And we talked about it in the editorial conference today. It seems to me that it took exactly 12 years from the time we got the first county unit system decision in the spring of 1962 to yesterday to get the last decision that we had a legal house. To go through the process of making everybody's vote legal. And I think it had tremendous impact. We would not have gotten the kind of responses out of state government in the last 12 years that we've gotten if we hadn't destroyed the county unit system, which is an essential part of the reorganization and apportionment process. But in terms of the legislature, it really hasn't made all that much difference. It stopped initially the segregationist kinds of speeches that were on the floor, and that was a very essential part of the beginning of the changing of minds. It stopped because Leroy Johnson was sitting on the Senate floor and nobody had the courage to say to his face what they had been saying all of his life behind his back. It had the effect of bringing a more diverse group of people to the House and somewhat more diverse group to the Senate. But what it really did was it allowed some stability to be introduced in the Senate. In our Senate, prior to that, you had each of the three counties in a congressional district rotated the senator. Each had him for 2 years, and then another one would supply the senator for 2 years. And there was no continuity.
Was that by tradition or law?
It was by law. But it could be waived. There was an interesting thing. If the county commission waived it, as they did once in Carl Sanders' case. He was elected from another county because they somehow waived the law, and I don't remember anymore what that was all about. In terms of the end product of legislation that gets passed, it means obviously that the legislature is much stronger and the governor is much less strong as the man who really ramrods things. But I doubt that it had much impact on the final administrative process of state government, because 60-day-a-year legislators just aren't going to know enough about state government to change the basic functioning of state government. And they never have understood that they could have major impact if they would deal with policy questions and let the implementation go. Every Southern legislature thinks that it ought to get deeply involved in the implementation process and doesn't understand that its job is to set policy. And why that should be the case is absolutely beyond me. But it's true in every state that I know anything about. You watch every major legislative squabble, and it's always about the implementation of one particular piece of legislation that was passed 3 or 4 years ago.
Well, if you have a smart executive office, you encourage that sort of thing, because then the policy decision remains in the government, the budget decision remains in the governor's hands. Exactly. Let them argue about whether there ought to be carpet on the floor of the executive office. And you make the major policy decision.
Exactly right. And the legislators have been willing to be fooled that way for forever. And I don't really see them getting much more savvy about that. In fact, the more savvy they are, the more they seem to take delight, or the more savvy you think they'd be, the more they seem to take delight in arguing about what color the carpet ought to be on their own damn floor. It's just the most ridiculous kind of argument. Somebody said one time, you know, that the governor's offices in Georgia, I know it was interesting, I wrote a line one time, and thought it was the best thing I ever saw about state politics in America. He said that governments, American governors were ankle deep in talent and neck deep in trouble. That's really true. Legislators may be worse than that, but if state government doesn't do better in the next few years, it's not going to function in this state except just as a pass-through kind of an operation. Federal money going to local communities.
Is it just considered politically impossible to do anything about reducing the number of counties in Georgia?
We keep arguing about it, and we keep trying, and there are a lot of people who would like to do it. But again, the legislature is not willing to undertake that. Though a lot of those politicians would be much better off if they would, because now they're running in 6 and 7 counties where they could reduce down, and they could run from one county if they would and comply with one county's laws if they would do it. But they just don't want to do it.
How about constitutional reform?
Now, we tried to get a new constitution and just failed completely, so that I suppose we have at least one of the most antiquated constitutions. Maybe even the Texas people call it constitutional convention.
Louisiana just voted one in.
That's right. We can't do that.
Do you see this as a future issue somewhere down the road? What's it going
to? I think the biggest issue, though, if I were going to run for governor today, I think the one issue I'd run on was county control.
Wouldn't the constitutional convention be a way of doing that?
Yeah, but that's a hard thing for that. That phrase frightens voters.
Constitutional convention or county consolidation?
Convention, constitutional convention. That sounds like you're beginning to tamper with what the forefathers did. You know, it doesn't have a thing in the world to do with that, but that's what it sounds like. And but everybody in this state knows there needs to be connected to all of this. And that's just an issue of sitting around waiting for somebody to have courage enough to run it. But all the county politicians will tell them that they'd be instant death, you know. So if a politician was sitting around and he listened to any county politician, they'd say, oh my God, I can't.
Anything else?